Hello, Tom here. Before we get into this week's episode of Last Orders, I just wanted to let you all know about our very exciting online event that we've got coming up. On Thursday, the 21st of March at 7 p.m, Brendan O'Neill will be joined by the great Matt Ridley, the science writer and the co-author of Viral, The Search for the Origin of COVID-19. Matt and Brendan will be live and in conversation on Zoom, talking about the cover-up of the lab leak theory, the dire consequences of lockdown and the perils of net zero. They'll also be taking your questions from the audience. This is a free event exclusive to Spiked supporters, members of our online donor community. So if you're already a Spiked supporter, you can sign up right now on our online donor hub. And if you're not already a Spiked supporter, now is surely the perfect time to sign up. For as little as £5 each month, you can get your ticket to this event. Plus, you'll enjoy loads of other exclusive perks like ad-free reading on the website, access to our comment section, and many more events like this one. To become a Spiked supporter, just go to spiked-online.com/supporters. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. Thanks so much and see you there. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss sin taxes on vaping, the miserable call to ban cigars, and Michael Gove's crackdown on extremism. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. There's no getting rid of me.
And we're delighted to be joined on the show today by a very special guest, Candice Holdsworth, who is a writer and broadcaster. Candice, how are you doing today?
I am good. So happy to join you.
So we're going to talk first, I think, about some of the nanny state topics which have come up in recent weeks. Chris, we've been talking a lot about the crackdown on vaping from government, originally about the single-use vapes ban, but with the budget last week, we've seen Sunak's government step it up a notch with a tax on vape products. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, it's more terrible news. I do think that government policy may be specifically aimed at annoying me at the moment. It's difficult to see what else they're trying to achieve, because they certainly aren't pursuing their public health objectives or their economic objectives very effectively. So, this is directly, they've finally got me. So I don't use a disposable vape, so that didn't affect me, and I don't smoke. So the anti smoking stuff didn't affect me, but they got me on the old refillables. As with all these things, it was kind of rumoured, wasn't it, that flew a kite a few weeks beforehand saying that maybe he's going to tax vapes. I thought if he did, I didn't think he'd do it at all, but honestly, I keep being surprised. It just goes to show you can never be too cynical, doesn't it? I didn't think he'd do it because I didn't see how they were going to defend it, given that, you know, it obviously stops people smoking and that's his main thing, is stopping people smoking. But if he did do it, I thought it'd be like 50p a bottle or something like that, which would be irritating, but not too bad. It's actually going to be £3 a bottle for me. And for people who don't know this market, you can get a bottle of vape juice for 75p. A quid is a common, but I actually pay a little bit more. I pay £2.99 for mine. Don't know why, it's unflavoured. But anyway, I'll have to start shopping around. Anyway, so it's going to double the price for me. So for somebody paying £1, it's going to quadruple the price. The stupid government said, oh, we're going to keep the difference between cigarettes and vapes the same by sticking 40p on a pack of fags. Well, you don't need to be blooming Milton Friedman to work out that is not keeping the difference the same. And even if it did, it's not about the difference. It's about the actual cost of vaping and how much, you know, vaping is worth it to you. You know, if you really prefer cigarettes, but you vape because vaping is so cheap, then you may well go back to smoking, particularly given that the going rate for a pack of cigarettes now, in effect, for a lot of people, is a fiver a pack. You know, you can go, yeah, it's not even like a man in a pub anymore. You can just go into a shop and say, give me a pack of cheap cigarettes, and you can often get one for a fiver a pack. So it's a stupid bloody thing he's doing. And he's charging more for the supposedly high nicotine vapes. There are no high nicotine vapes in Britain. The EU banned them years ago, but the relatively high ones are going to be £3 a bottle. The lower nicotine strength is going to be £2 a bottle. The zero nicotine strength is going to be £1 a bottle. I don't even know why he's taxing zero nicotine strength. It's just blooming water with a bit of propyl glycol in it. What an idiot. You know, what can you say? I just think the government is going to completely lose control of both the vaping and tobacco market in a very short space of time. It's got this illusion of control at the moment. You know, it's like Hitler moving around his imaginary tanks in his bunker. You know, they think that they're controlling the price of things. They're not, because people aren't paying the legal price for a lot of things. We already know we have a huge number of illegal disposable vapes in particular. The entire disposable market obviously is going to become illegal when they ban disposable vapes. The tobacco illicit market is so out of control that the government hasn't even made a serious attempt to measure it for about 3 or 4 years. And its measurement was nonsense anyway, just optimistic guesses. They are losing control of something and making it more dangerous in the process and making it more accessible to kids and indeed cheaper in the process. It's idiotic public policy making. Doesn't make sense on any level, whether you take it from a liberal point of view or a public health point of view or anything else. And this government just seems to be floundering around looking for things that will, I don't know, get people voting for them, you might think. But it seems to me, as I said in Spike recently, there seems to be a case for saying that he is deliberately trying to lose as many votes as possible. And he's doing a sort of Brewster's Millions type challenge, trying to get the Tory number of seats in the next parliament down to zero. He's going the right way about it with this kind of stuff, as far as I'm concerned. A legacy of completely destroying the Conservative Party. Nobody ever wants to vote for you again. He's done a good job with the kids, that's for sure. You know, he's certainly alienated anybody under the age of 18.
A page in history is better than no page in history. Candice, what do you make of all this? Why do you think they're doing it?
I find it so interesting. I mean, you could talk about Sunak on a personal level. I mean, what's been reported about him is that he's got a bit of a faddish approach to health himself. You know, he does like those fasting diets, and he's clearly very disgusted by vapes. He finds them quite disgusting. You know, when there was that video of him talking to children about all the different flavors, and you can see that he really finds it distasteful. He really doesn't like smoking. And, you know, you get people like that who say, "I hate smokers," and they talk about them as if they're the most disgusting people in the world. But I think there's also a broader societal shift as well, which I find really interesting. People are very conscious about their health these days. You know, you get all these very popular podcasts like the Huberman podcast, and people are very into longevity and, you know, like measuring their blood glucose levels and trying to figure out what foods spike their blood sugar. Yeah, there's a lot of that around. And, you know, I'm not necessarily opposed to it, because it could be, you know, quite personally empowering for people. They learn about their health. They learn how to take care of themselves. But I think what's creeping in, especially with public health, is this sort of population level interventionism. So instead of individuals just learning about things and making choices for themselves, you've got people wanting to bring in these laws, which, you know, ban people under a certain age from smoking, or they want to ban junk food advertising, or there's this big thing about ultra processed foods. And it seems to be that might be the way it's shifting, because are we a society that still values individual liberty in that way? Or is it sort of moving towards the public health bodies having more of a say over what we do with our health? And I can really see it moving that way, even with people like Wes Streeting. You know, he's fascinated by the Singaporean system, and he wants to have something very similar to that here. And instead of using technology to sort of allow people to make decisions for themselves, it might be trying to nudge them in certain directions. And I'd be very interested to see which way it all goes.
Definitely. And you're bang on about this sort of odd kind of trend towards longevity and all that. There's this whole kind of like podcast self-help infrastructure, which seems to exist, which seems to be devoted to promoting the most miserable lifestyle possible. Like, they're really anti-drinking. They're really anti absolutely anything, which is really, really weird. But you're right. And given the fact that Sunak is a kind of creature of Silicon Valley to some extent, it wouldn't surprise me if he was influenced by a lot of that nonsense.
Definitely. Like that billionaire, and I've forgotten his name. I'm trying to remember. It's just slipped off the top of my head. Who's now obsessed with longevity. And I mean, he was even having blood platelets transferred from his son to him. And, you know, with seemingly no awareness of how vampiric that was and how disgusting that was, how that seemed to people. And there is this health obsessiveness, definitely. And I think it could become even more so with using our phones to track ourselves every instant. You know, how are we doing in all these various categories of our health?
Mm-hmm. And Chris, going back to vaping, how do we compare now to where other kind of similar countries are with this? Because for a long time, we often said that vaping was the one thing that the kind of British public health establishment was relatively sensible on. But in quite a short space of time, it seems to be that we've gone heading pretty quickly in the other direction. Where do we sit now in terms of our approach to vaping, would you say?
Well, if all this comes in, we will be sitting pretty low down. I mean, I edit the Nanny State Index. Check it out, folks, nannystateindex.org. So I'm pretty familiar with how the rest of Europe, or most of Europe, regulates this kind of stuff. And the UK and Ireland have always been very good on it because they haven't gold-plated EU regulations or taxed juices or banned flavours or anything. Certainly there are EU countries that tax e-cigarettes. Most of them don't, but some of them do. At varying degrees, like from a real token amount of a few pence, really, to quite a bit. In Denmark, I think they have the highest tax. It's €4 a bottle, which is obviously a lot, but very close to what the UK is talking about here. You've got to remember, this £3 I'm talking about is plus VAT, right? So you charge the VAT on top of the duty. So it's an extra £3.60 in effect. So that would put us up there with Denmark as having the highest e-cigarette tax, probably in the world. I don't think there's anywhere outside of Europe that taxes e-cigarettes more. So, yeah, we would have pretty much the highest e-cigarette tax in the world. I guess there are other countries that ban disposables. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but no doubt more and more countries will ban them. But we certainly seem to be one of the first doing that. And there's still talk about clamping down on flavours and packaging and all the rest of it's gone out to consultation. It's just nuts. And I just don't know what they expect to happen. It's this sort of Nirvana fallacy, isn't it, really, that they imagine that somehow they're going to create this generation of people who don't do anything that is slightly risky or enjoyable or artificial. And it's not going to happen. It's a straight substitution. Oh, by the way, just mentioning my theory that the government is out to get me. It's a slight digression, but I did a freedom of information request a while ago. Somebody else had done the same thing, and I thought that's a good idea. I just sent an FOI to the Department of Health saying, can you send me any documents in which I am named? And I only got 2 years back because I guess they keep changing the name of the Department of Health. So I think they just gave me whatever they had since it became whatever it's called at the moment. And there was a few interesting bits in there, not that much. But the best one was on the day that Javed Khan, actually, I guess it was before it was published. You know, the Javed Khan review that had the proposal for this generational smoking ban and all the other stuff in it in the first place. Well, this is clearly just before it was published and it'd been passed around the Department of Health. And I mentioned in an email, it says, actually reading the Khan review recommendations, Chris Snowden's blood pressure is going to go through the roof when this is published. No. So they're out to get me, Tom.
Congratulations. That's fantastic. I mean, Candice, do you think this is, combined with this generational smoking ban, which we've been bemoaning on this podcast ever since it was announced, do you think this is the sort of, that sort of final kind of victory for this nanny state prohibitionism? Because particularly when you take something like vaping, it is the answer to that thought experiment of if they could come up with a cigarette that didn't harm you, would they still want to ban it? I mean, it's like 95% safer at a conservative estimate. And yet, nevertheless, the state still has a problem with it. Do you think it is just that kind of miserable prohibitionism has just sort of won across the political spectrum in Britain now?
I think for the time being, perhaps. You know, people speak a lot about how, you know, Gen Z, for instance, they smoke less, they drink less, they're much less, they don't take as many risks. You know, they're very conscious about their health. But will that last? I don't know, because you see these shifts over time. You know, you might see a very clean living, clean cut generation, but then the next generation just wants to loosen things up a bit and then they push back. I mean, I think right now we do seem to be going through a bit of a sort of like conformist period. I really do. I don't think people value individual liberty. There are people who do value individual liberty, obviously, but I just don't think as much. And I think that a lot of it started years ago, you know, when you start making arguments for the public good about public health. And I feel like there just wasn't that much pushback and people are more inclined to go, yes, well, you know, you should just go along with it because it is good for your health and you should trust the authorities on that. So, you know, they're doing their best for you.
Yeah, can I just mention something that Steve Bryan wrote for Conservative Home the other day? So touching on what you're saying there, he says, this is defending the generational smoking ban. He says, now, Steve Bryan, if you've forgotten, was public health minister for about 5 minutes under Theresa May, I think it was. He says, I would contest that in a publicly funded system, the state has a right and indeed the responsibility to act on population public health prevention measures. That is just a charter for totalitarianism, basically, because there is no end to what you can do to people if you think that the fact that the health service being publicly funded means that the state has to control people's health. Also, by the way, in this article, it's headlined, Sunak's smoking ban has the backing of the vast majority of Conservative voters. And he starts off by saying 2/3 of adults in Britain back the government's smoking ban plan, including nearly 3/4 of Conservative voters, according to a poll carried out by ASH. Now, you look at the poll by ASH, and ASH have got a track record in very misleading polls, but this is probably the worst one ever. The question is, how strongly, if at all, do you support or oppose a goal to make Britain a country where no one smokes? A goal, right? Nothing about that, nothing about prohibition, nothing about the policy at all, just basically an aspiration. And from that, 61% of people said yes. This is unbelievably slippery from ASH, isn't it? I'm surprised that the pollster even allowed them to ask the question. This smacks of a question that you resort to when you've already tried a more accurate question and you haven't got the results you wanted. Do you know what I mean? I'm pretty sure there's a survey out there that ASH paid for that will never be published because it didn't get what they want. And it's quite interesting that even with this question, which loads of people would agree with, they don't agree with prohibition or any anti-smoking policies necessarily, still only got 61%. It makes me wonder how popular this actually is, this policy.
That's quite encouraging. So what, there's 40% of the country roughly who don't want smoking to go away, like they feel like it would be a bad...
Well, a lot of them are don't knows, but you know, we'll take the don't knows, won't we?
Yeah. I mean, if they're going to manipulate the polls, we might as well do so as well. But while we're on the subject of smoking, Chris, should we also talk briefly about the cigar aspect to this consultation on the generational smoking ban? Because I know you've written something about this as well.
Yeah, so it's just a pathetic study came out a week or two ago saying that there's this epidemic of people, and especially kids, taking up cigars and pipes and hookah and what they call non-cigarette combustible tobacco. And it's very, very obvious if you look at the data, although they claim there's something like a four-fold increase in the number of people using these non-cigarette products, it's not like a gradual increase over the course of 10 years. It's this overnight increase in March 2020. Now, you may remember what happened in March 2020, lockdowns, pandemic, and so on. A lot of these kind of surveys went online, having previously been face-to-face. I think we talked about this before in relation to problem gambling, because online problem gambling surveys also massively exaggerate the number of problem gamblers, basically because you have a selection bias. People who are interested in gambling are more likely to say yes if they get an email saying, would you like to do a survey about gambling? And whatever the reason for the increase with the online survey in this instance, it's very obvious it was just a methodological change, which they've since not reversed because it's cheaper to do online surveys. So it's obviously a statistical artifact. There hasn't been a massive increase in kids smoking pipes and cigars. We would have probably noticed that, you know. But the whole purpose of this junk science was to keep Sunak's feet to the fire and make sure that he includes everything in the kitchen sink in his stupid generational ban, including snuff and Rizzlers and heated tobacco and essentially everything but vaping, and probably vaping will be stuck in it sooner or later. So it's just, you know, more garbage public health, politically driven rubbish designed to put pressure on the government, and the government will doubtless capitulate. It's already put all this stuff in there, you know. But it really shouldn't. I mean, obviously, we don't agree with, you know, any aspect of the generational tobacco ban. But the idea that in the future, some man who's just got married can't have a cigar in his wedding reception, yeah, it's just sickening to me. This is a party of Winston Churchill, for God's sake.
No, it really does underline just how miserable it is.
I think that's such a good point. It really illustrates how puritanical it all could be. It's so true, you know, like, you're at a joyous event and you want to smoke a cigar or have a hookah or whatever, and you can't do that. And, you know, when people are operating at the abstract, they forget about those very specific examples.
I'm going to start smoking a pipe. I've been wanting to for years anyway.
Feels very on brand. So, yes, I mean, it sounds like you haven't got long left. so you might as well try it. Although I suppose the escalator means that we can all carry on smoking if we want to.
Yeah, we can carry on. Sorry, I thought when you said you haven't got long left, you heard about some terrible tradition there. Might as well start smoking. But now I'm going to start smoking regardless of my health.
So let's move on to one of the stories, which has been one of the big stories of this week. By the time people actually listen to this, it might have actually moved on a fair bit. But Michael Gove is laying out a new definition of extremism this week in order to tackle the sort of, he says, the rise in Islamist and far-right extremism, but we really know which one is probably most preoccupying government at the moment, given the pro-Hamas protests and everything else that's been going on. So there's not a lot of details which are out at the moment. This announcement is going to take place on Thursday, recording this on Tuesday, but broadly speaking, it seems that it's going to attempt to clamp down on groups who set out to subvert democracy and who want to deny other people fundamental rights, is one quote. It seems to be primarily about making sure that Whitehall and government kind of cut ties with, do not fund, do not consult with various groups with links to Islamism, with dodgy associations. And that's particularly in the context of all of the individuals who've been flushed out in recent weeks, who might have been, say, advising the Metropolitan Police, but had previously praised the founder of Hamas, which is one example that came out in February, as well as various other cases of even counter-extremism money ending up in the hands of groups who have a track record of associating with or praising Islamist extremist groups. So, as I say, there's a lot that we don't know. Depending on who you read, the definition is going to be broader than it is currently. It's going to be narrower than it is currently. Who knows? But Candice, what do you make of this attempt to crack down on the extremism problem by means of these sorts of definitions from central government?
Well, I found it so fascinating that some of the pushback came from social conservatives within the Conservative Party, who really felt like they could suffer from some definition of extremism that excluded their values, that immediately saw the threat. And that isn't what you would think. You'd think that they would be very for that, but they're actually not. And I think what they've shown is that, you know, if you have, you know, someone with a certain view of Britain or what Britain could be defining it, it could be horribly misused in the future. I mean, we all know at the moment that there is a problem with, say, Islamic extremism. And, you know, we have to find a way of tackling that because it's not just, you know, the sharing of ideas. I mean, it's, you know, threatening people, bodily harm. People are having to go into hiding. But of course, the obvious question is, how do we do that without making ourselves unrecognizable, making ourselves a less free society, making ourselves more authoritarian? How do we deal with bad and malicious actors? And I think it's interesting that even within the Conservative Party, they don't trust their own government to be able to come up with a good enough definition of extremism, which kind of leaves us floundering a little bit, I think.
Absolutely. And that was striking, that pushback. It does seem like some people's experience of, say, the gender wars or other kind of free speech battles of recent years have actually given them quite a firm sense of the principles at stake rather than it just being them defending their own views. But Chris, what have you made of these plans, such as we know about them so far?
You should be allowed to hate people in a free society. As simple as that. And I don't approve of hatred of groups, particularly, you know, hating people just because of their religion, their race, but you should be allowed to do it, and you should be allowed to protest in the street, and you should be able to march so long as you stay within the law. And the law is, we've had the laws for a long time. I don't like these people protesting every Saturday, you know, for Hamas, but they should be allowed to do it, so long as they don't start vandalizing statues and slashing paintings and all the rest of it. So I don't see what need we have for this. And I think the right's commitment to free speech has been revealed as a bit of a sham in recent weeks, partly because of these protests. You can see a lot of people now saying, well, they shouldn't be allowed to march. So, yeah, they should be allowed to march. And people should be allowed to say pretty much anything, even if it's hateful, you know, within the usual parameters of not actually, you know, sending people death threats. So why is it always Michael Gove? What is Michael Gove's actual job? Does anyone know? He just seems to have this roving portfolio. What is he doing? Is he leveling up?
He's leveling up counter-extremism. No, he's...
he seems to do everything.
As well as everything else, he's quote-unquote community secretary, as well as everything else. Minister for paperclips, minister for leveling up, so...
Yeah, it just means he can go around banning things. Michael Gove is arguably the worst person in the government and has been for at least 10 years. You look at every stupid ban... It's Michael Gove is there, even the quite trivial ones. He was behind the plastic straw ban. He was behind the ban on the third-party sale of cats and dogs, whatever that means. He banned house coal, which annoyed me.
Wood burners? Wasn't that another one?
Wood burning Goves. Laughing gas, he spearheaded that one. Antique ivory, he banned. So much stuff comes down to Michael Gove looking for something to do. And he's looking for something to do now, and why is it? I don't know. Was it all sparked by Lee Anderson saying those stupid things about Sadiq Khan? I can't remember. It's all displacement. Everything's displacement.
Well, that's the other thing, is because there already is like a definition of extremism since like 2011, which sounds very similar to the one that they're going to sketch out. I think the difference is here they're going to kind of provide a kind of blacklist of various organisations like the Muslim Council of Britain, who they don't think government should be dealing with.
Well, they shouldn't be funding any of these groups for startups. So that's an easy way to sort out not funding extremists. Don't fund any civil society groups. Let them fund themselves.
I mean, that's the other thing. If you want to, surely an answer to a lot of these scandals that we've seen in recent weeks, like the number of advisors that the Met were working with who had previously led a chant of from the river to the sea, was the case of one gentleman, as well as this guy who had been caught praising Hamas, who was also had some sort of role at the Muslim Council of Britain. Surely the answer to this is to get rid of these advisory councils that they've set up for themselves, which always end up to be, seem to have kind of people with dodgy links, shall we say, wash into them. There was that case a couple of years ago where they had to sack one of their Islamophobia advisors because of the fact that he had been sharing and supporting the protests against that Lady of Heaven film on the grounds that it was blasphemous. You just think, why not just set the law in Parliament? What is allowed, what isn't? Have that enforced. And if you want to consult the community, you do that as an elected representative. You don't go to these ridiculous organizations which have appointed themselves as the standard bearers of the Muslim community.
Yeah, so-called community leaders who always turn out 10 minutes later to be mad mullahs.
Exactly. Like, just get rid of that whole layer of the multicultural sort of identitarian state and you wouldn't have this problem.
Yeah, stop funding NGOs, 100%. And by definition, you're going to stop funding extremists. But there's more to it than that, isn't there, Tom? This is going to be about free speech. And obviously, anybody who worries about the slippery slope is absolutely right to worry about it. Because you see what, you know, the loony left consider extremism these days. Do you know what I mean? They think the IA is far right. They think everyone's far right. What isn't far right these days? So, you know, a lot of people are going to find themselves silenced if Michael bloody Gove decides to make this his latest mission.
But have we lost confidence in ourselves to sort of withstand these sort of challenges to democracy? Because you think in the 70s, I mean, Mary Whitehouse was like bringing blasphemy libels against magazines and things like that. And even though she was a sort of, you know, voice of protest against the sexual revolution, I think like the wave of people who were just more interested in experimentation and free expression was too great. And I mean, she wasn't ultimately successful. But do we have that same feeling of confidence now about where we are?
No, everyone's like Mary Whitehouse these days. No, we haven't, because we're living in a neo-prohibitionist time. And, you know, it's the agenda of the Festival Light, obviously, hasn't carried through. But in terms of censoriousness, it's at least as bad. And Mary Whitehouse was a figure of fun, and she never got that very much mainstream support. That's the big difference between the Puritanism now and the Puritanism of Mary Whitehouse in the 70s.
Yeah. And there's even a rehabilitation of her slightly because people think, well, she was right about things like pornography, but then they completely forget about her censoriousness when it came to art and literature and theatre.
Well, they're equally censorious, these people, aren't they? It would be very fitting if Mary Whitehouse is fully rehabilitated and they put her on the fourth plinth or something.
No, I always find it fascinating that people don't make that connection. Like, Owen Jones is, for all intents and purposes, like the modern day Mary Whitehouse, but he just has no concept of that whatsoever. His whole job is running around being upset at what other people have said before he got into the whole Hamas commentary. I'll put it that way, to be legally circumspect. But no, you're right, Chris, this is a free speech issue, not least because in some of the reporting, I think they were saying that Gove at one point wanted to make this definition sort of legally enshrined until it was pointed out to him that it would be, given how broad it was, it would potentially criminalise the Scottish National Party.
Oh, really?
So that tells you everything about how easily these kind of broad legal definitions can be abused and capture all kinds of people.
Every cloud.
I wasn't going to say it.
It was funny, though, reading the one that they've got at the moment in terms of it's all framed around opposition to fundamental British values, including democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty. That describes most of the political media class. So, again, maybe there's a silver lining in all of this. We're fast running out of time, but Candice, in each of the episodes we've taken to asking our guests, given that this is a very libertarian podcast, given that we're against banning things on principle, if you had to have one ban, what would it be? And it's got to be something really, really petty, vindictive, just something you happen to really dislike rather than anything too worthy.
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be most television adverts, which I just hate. I find them grimly unfunny and profoundly depressing. And I think white noise would be preferable. I think I would prefer it. It's like this new sort of like surreal, crazy, quirky turn in advertising, which is just awful and deeply, deeply alienating. So yeah, that would be...
Well, ITV's profits fell by 60% last year, so you might not have to put up with them much longer.
It's just the worst. Have you seen that one with the Müller rice advert where the kid says he wants it warm? I just think, who thought of that? Who finds this funny? I don't know anyone who laughs at that.
Have you seen the one with Alan Cummings?
No.
It comes up all the time on Sky when I'm watching things like Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's like literally the only advert that seems to appear. I don't even know who Alan Cummings is. He's just some annoying Scottish guy. And I still don't even know what he's advertising. That's how ineffective it is. He's just encouraging to watch some boring programme, basically. But he's very irritating because he just starts, "Hi, I'm Alan Cummings."
Is that the point of these? I'm not someone who knows the theory of advertising, but is that the point of it? Is it the more annoying it is, it's going to stick in your head somehow?
Yes.
I've never understood why.
Yeah, like Go Compare and stuff like that. They're deeply and deliberately annoying, so you remember the name of the company. You can see how that would backfire, annoying people.
But I had a friend who came over from another country and she was like, why are there so many furry animals in British adverts? I mean, she was like quite perplexed.
The meerkats.
Yes, but just everywhere, there's always someone dressed up as a furry animal. And she was like, I think she felt like pretty infantilized by it all.
Even the adverts were a lot better in the 80s.
I think so.
I think it was less regulated, for one thing. You could advertise Hamlet cigars and stuff. You didn't have to have, you know, three people in a pub. You could have lots of people in the pub drinking, fighting. It's a better time.
Yes.
Well, on that nostalgic note, Chris... Candice, thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.